Comparison with divine precepts, religious life under poverty, chastity, and obedience.
Somewhere along the line, picked up some literature on a group called the Keze community.
You ever hear about them? Keze.
In France, who publish a very fine magazine called Verbum Caro, word flesh, so to speak. They are, I call modern Huguenots, they are Calvinists, at least by theological persuasion, but they are monks and live the monastic life, both externally and many ways even, internally. They follow a tradition which closely approximates the Augustinian with some interest in the Benedictine tradition. They write a great deal. Their publications come out every month. When I get a chance, I read them. We don't get them here. And one of my students, who spent a whole year, a student, now entering the Lutheran ministry, who spent a whole year studying Lutheran monasticism. It was a private, independent study course, and I had him do all the reading that he possibly could. He even bought himself a tape recorder, part of the course, I told him, to record the conversations that he would have with Father Krongheder at Oxford, who was the Lutheran monk who organized the community there. Well, in the course not only of working with him, but of course the whole background of one's knowledge of this, this is something which Protestantism in many ways has also discovered, because the idea of perfection, in other words, of a growing in the friendship of God, is characteristic of quite a few traditions in Protestantism. Methodists are outstanding in this respect. Many of the so-called free churches, especially those that are not on the liberal side, I'm thinking, for example, of the Quakers, of the Salvation Army, of the Mennonites, of the various types of Pentecostals. There is a search for growing in virtue, in the love of God, which is way beyond that bare negative minimum of keeping out of sin, or better, admitting your sinfulness and trusting that God has covered over your sins. Between that absolute minimum at one side of the spectrum, I am and always remain a sinner, but God does not impute to me my sins, albeit I am sinful. At the other extreme, you find things that are extremely close to what you might call traditional Catholic teaching, as found in Augustine, Aquinas, and others. And I have found in dealing with Protestant theologians, again depending on the tradition, this is something which is where you find sympathy, because when you read the pages of the Gospels with an unjaundiced eye, there is a lot there to recommend perfection, love of God, growth in virtue, and not merely admitting that I am a scoundrel and I can't do a thing about it. The historical development, before we get into the theology, is of some consequence. First, just to take our own three men and pit them, as it were, against the New Testament background. The document describing Christian perfection, and in many ways the classic document for this, is the Acts of the Apostles, where we have described for us the early Christian community. And Protestant theology, this is significant. When he talks about perfection, and correctly says, if you want to know how Christians should behave and live, let's look at the early community. It's too seldom looked at. You see, there is an attention now to the communal aspect of Christianity. What are some of the qualities of that early community? For one thing, they lived relatively in common. They didn't live completely in common, but at least they would meet periodically. They would be no pray in common. In fact, the beginnings of the Christian community are the 9 days. between the Ascension and Pentecost, where all there was to Christianity was in one big room. But that being in a room, by the way, is not coincidental. There was a sense of belongingness, of togetherness, of an interdependence, of a mutual inspiration, all the other things that are implicit in community, which is found, and dramatically, as I see, even in that first week before the Holy Spirit came. Then as you read the pages of the Acts of the Apostles, the word community keeps recurring time and again. Koinonia. See? The living together. And not only living together physically, because after all they had to do their respective jobs and such. They couldn't always be together. I don't know, getting each other's hair. Even saints keep on the trouble to each other when they're too much together. At least that has been proved by history. They tried to avoid that. But they would share things in common. And among the things that we know they shared in common was that which is most difficult to share in common. Your possessions. And we have that illustrated in a tragic scene in the Acts, where you remember the famous story of Ananias and Sapphira, two worthies who, it seems, voluntarily, from all appearances it seems that voluntarily they had agreed to share their goods with the rest of the Christian community. It seemed they didn't have to do it. They would have been Christians, not perhaps as good, but Christians without so sharing that. Well, then you remember the story. And Peter asked Ananias, how about it? How much money was involved? And he gave a certain sum, less than the actual price. What he did with the rest, we don't know. He gave it to a brother, he invested it, buried it in the ground, whatever he did, but he didn't turn all the money in after having agreed that he would. And then Peter, a forthright man, if there ever was one, called him in good Greek, or pardon me, Aramaic, you liar. And Ananias expired. Then Sapphira came along, and you think Peter would have spared her the risk, but no, he didn't. We can safely believe he was under the inspiration of God. We hope he was. He must have been, otherwise they wouldn't have died so expeditiously. Well, as Sapphira repeated the sequence, she too died, and they carried her after her husband. In other words, there is a sharing of things, a living beyond, you might say, the ordinary precepts of the Gospels already in the first church. In other words, Christ's words, and this is the most important passage, if you will be perfect, go sell what you have, give to the poor, come follow me. Now, behind the statement of Christ is a hypothesis. If, in other words, a person need not so dedicate himself. Yet, to all accounts, it seems many, for all what's described in the Acts, isn't the whole Christian community. See, there were thousands of Christians, 3,000 as a matter of fact, on the first Pentecost Sunday. We don't hear about the other 2,000, say 900, how they comported themselves. Nevertheless, the ideal of Christianity as depicted in the Acts goes beyond the call of duty. There is a communality there. Augustine, in certain ways, is the father of Western monasticism. Because while it is true that there had been monks in both the East, not so much the West, but certainly in the East, way before Augustine, men like Anthony, for example, or Paul, nevertheless, Augustine, with his genius, gave monasticism, or the religious life, a theology, which has ever since remained embedded in at least Catholic Christianity. All states of perfection, all religious orders of whatever description, all theologically of great depth to St. Augustine. In other words, he not only became a Christian, but he, reading the Acts, he wanted to become as good a Christian as he possibly could. And for him, that meant going beyond the call of duty. The Augustinian rule, or the rule of Augustine, some time ago I had occasion to write two articles for an encyclopedia on the rule of Augustine. And in the process, rummaged through various source material that otherwise I wouldn't have read, and I was surprised, really, to find how remarkably close that rule is to even the most modern religious states of profession. Augustine anticipated more than most people give him credit for. Aquinas, so in other words, with Augustine, it was a monastic community, which, however, was engaged in apostolic work, because Augustine was nothing if not apostolic. After all, he was a bishop. He went abroad, he traveled, he attended meetings, to put it mildly, he rode mountains. And in many ways, he identified, you might say, the state of perfection, which we are talking about, with also working for the neighbor. That's significant. Why? Because came a day, not too much later, a couple of hundred years, but in the Christian history that's a short time, when the states of perfection, especially in the East, became more and more identified with isolation from the world. And then, in the later Middle Ages, when the new religious orders came into existence, there was in many ways a return to the rule of Augustine, the concept that Augustine had, of combining the two. Now Aquinas was, as you know, a member of the order of preachers, commonly called Dominican, and he represented, in many ways, the first modern equivalent of the state of perfection conceived by Augustine, except on a much more massive scale. Order of preachers, OP, Ordo Predicatorum, means, of course, by itself, literally, those who follow a religious rule and whose main concern or apostolate is to preach. Now, Augustine wrote a great deal about the religious life. His most important contribution is his rule. There happen to be two principal rules, a longer and a shorter. It is less certain whether the longer is completely his own. It seems it was embellished by his followers. The shorter rule of Augustine is certainly his. In Aquinas' case, he also wrote a great deal on the subject, both in the Summa Theologica and in special treatises. Notably, in defense of the religious state against those who were attacking it. Who were attacking it? Well, among others, there were those, clerics incidentally, who felt that monks ought to be in monasteries, and not, as they said in good Latin, gallivanting. He defended the combination and appealed to the example of Christ, who was perfection personified, who nevertheless, as he said, went about doing good. He didn't just stay put. Wait, if perchance some needy soul might come to ask him for help. Finally, in Bellarmine reaches another stage and historic peak in the whole development of the concept of perfection as conceived in Catholicism. He, first of all, was a member of the Society of Jesus. He, therefore, was both inspired and impressed by the teachings of Ignatius of Loyola, who founded the Jesuits. And in his case, he too had to defend not just the Jesuits, who had the dubious reputation of being driven out of more countries than any single group of Catholics in Christian history. There are still some countries where we are forbidden by law to operate. Whenever, for example, I write to Mexico, even now in 1964, I never, to my very good friends, whom I know, 40 of them perhaps, studied with them, I never write it on Reverend, I never add an SJ. It's Senor, and just the name. I never write to a Jesuit residence. It always is always some private house or institution. Legally, we are liable to imprisonment and even worse. Anyhow, this is an old story, and Bellarmine, of course, recognized that. He therefore defended not just the rule of the Jesuits, particularly Jesuit obedience, but also the religious state as such. Now, in his case, his concern was with the position of the early reformers. Let me just quote a passage or two. Those of you in the other class will recall, I just want to. In, for example, the are those who teach that Christian perfection requires the forsaking of house and home, wife and child, and the renunciation of such activities as are mentioned above. Actually, true perfection consists alone in the fear of God and real faith. And consequently, there is no question, according to the Confession of Augsburg, of living a life of perfection whereby a person believes that he pleases God by giving up home, family, and the rest. Or as in the 14th article of the 39 articles of the English Church, voluntary works, besides, over and above God's commandments, which they, namely the Catholics, call works of supererogation, cannot be taught without arrogance and impiety. For by them men do declare that they do not only render unto God as much as they are bound to, but they do more for his sake, which they say is contrary to the teachings of Christ, who said, when you have done all you are commanded, say, we are still unprofitable servants. This was Bellarmine's concern, to defend going beyond the call of duty, which, as you can suspect immediately, is bound up with man's freedom. If, in other words, ex hypothesi, by supposition, man's will is utterly impotent even to keep the commandments of God, as is, of course, presupposed, you see, a fortiori, there can be no question of doing more than you're supposed to, if you cannot even do that, which you must do. If you do it, you can remove the you, put it in quotation marks. It is really God doing it in you, or for you. It is grace, not you. Now, monasticism, historically, is traditionally identified with this life of perfection. Unfortunately, the word has all kinds of rusty connotations that have no relevance to modern times, and as a consequence of which, the term better perhaps should not be used, but we're stuck with it, and there it is. Monasticism as such, and notice the distinction immediately, is the living out of this life of perfection that they have been taught over the centuries by the church, but in a community. In other words, it assumes that people live together in working out not just their salvation, but their sanctification. It is therefore distinct from what is called the eremitical life. This technically is called the cenobitic, just to give you the Greek terms. The cenobitic, the monastic community type of the life of perfection, has of course been the most common. Until modern times, you find very few authentic hermits in Europe, and perched on the top of a mountain peak, I saw a few hermitages, and the men happened to be out in the fields at the time, so without their permission, I went through their hermitage and saw how they lived and what they did. Well, it's pretty primitive, but actually the citizens from the local town had to also help them out. In other words, they weren't quite completely sealed off from the rest of the world. It's pretty difficult to just segregate yourself from the world completely in modern times. If nothing else, a Times reporter will get after you and take pictures. Yeah. So the most common and now practically the universal type of life of perfection which is bound by vows is called monastic. Yet technically, there are not too many, too many monks left. There are some, of course. The word is used actually and more accurately. Instead of monasticism, it is better called the religious life. On the assumption that there are certain people who not only go beyond the call of duty, but bind themselves by vow. Now, I'd like to say something about that. None of the vows directly belong here, because you can have, as we will see, states of perfection without binding yourself by vow. I mean, in other words, do more than I'm supposed to do, and do it for a lifetime, without taking an oath promising God that I will do so. That's an important distinction between going beyond duty and binding myself by vow to do so. The binding myself by vow is technically religious life or monasticism, if it is of that type. The vows generally are poverty, chastity, and obedience, with different implications and interpretations, vastly different among the different religious groups. We will see theologically where this fits in when we come to examine that huge chart on the board. In general, poverty means giving up the free use of what I have, in the sense that although I may own in some communities, I may not use without permission. Chastity, very obviously, not only giving up the the married life here and now, but giving up the prospects of marriage. And obedience, of being obedient to someone who is your superior, which implies some kind of a community. We'll examine the theology as we go through it. Now, from the east to the west, there was quite a difference and change. And although in both cases you have Christianity, perfection, Christian perfection, differed widely between East and West. As a rule, Eastern monasticism tends to be more rigorous, more demanding, harder on the flesh. Western monasticism tends to be comparatively lenient on the flesh and more demanding on the spirit. The concept, therefore, of obedience is stressed in the West. The concept of austerity is stressed in the East. The great father of Eastern monasticism is Basil, B-A-S-I-L. Among many others, he is the outstanding. The great father of Western monasticism, and there are almost no others in his day, was, of course, Benedict. Now, the Benedictine rule is followed by all Western religious communities, with, of course, sometimes major modifications, but nevertheless, the basic principle is there. There is a stress on balance, on silence, on prudence, on obedience, and above all on moderation, which is typical of Benedict. Perhaps it's typical of the West, and untypical of the aggressive East. Finally, still on the level of introduction, between the Middle Ages, going all the way back, if you want, even to Augustine, if you want to call him the early Middle Ages, there was quite a development in the concept of Christian perfection up to and including the Counter-Reformation, on two or three levels. One, the tendency was to interiorize Christian perfection. Instead of having it consist almost primarily, that's a curious expression, in exterior things. Early monasticism, certainly in the East, where it began, concentrated a lot on the external. You didn't eat much, you slept very little, and a man like Simon Stylites, as you know, spent upwards of, so the records say, 40 years living on top of a pillar. Don't ask me how he ate and what he did. Please, Simon Stylites, S-T-Y-L-I-T-E-S. He really means Simon, the one who lived on a pillar. That's what Stylites means. But other kinds of living in caves, living in deserts, living on pillars, above all living in mountain crags and mountain peaks. And even now, perhaps the best example of Simon pure Eastern monasticism still in existence is Mount Athos in the Mediterranean. It's a gem of solitariness, which Harnack said is the 4th century living in the 19th.
This is the Eastern Orthodox monastery of St. Catherine's on Mount Sinai.
In the austerity and solitariness, otherworldliness, you might say, of a place like Athos, compared to, say, a Jesuit house of studies attached to a big, bulging Babylonian university. Involvement in the world and not segregation from the world. All right, now the Counter-Reformation, therefore, that was one change. Secondly, one was to interiorize. Make it concentrate more on the practice of internal virtues. See? Terminating, and it is not a coincidence, that it took that many centuries until Aquinas came along to simply and in a single sentence identify Christian perfection with the love of God. Because there were so many things that were, so it seemed historically, typical of Christian perfection, as certainly lived out in monasticism, which may be called the love of God, but we'd have to read a book to know it. Along with that interiority, which is the development, as you would expect, there was a corresponding universalization. Christian perfection then became more and more open or available to more people. And by the time of the Counter-Reformation, there was no difficulty in applying it to people living in the world who might not take the vows, you see. In fact, even way before that, it is said, I don't have, except for the statement in a reputable writer, who said that at one time there were upwards of 2 million lay people belonging to the Franciscan Third Order in the late Middle Ages. And they were married people with families. Follow their rule, just to inject a personal note, my mother was a Franciscan tertiary, and she died shortly after my ordination when she was laid out in a Franciscan habit. Everybody looked at me. What is this? Well, I know from years of living with her, or she with me, that's better. But she certainly lived a life of very high perfection, although she was living in the world and working and so on. Now that idea of, in other words, not too closely identifying Christian perfection with what you might call the mechanics, which is a bad word, of the religious life, that is a development in Catholic theology. Aquinas pretty well developed it, and by the 16th century it was fairly in common possession, the idea. Unfortunately, not enough people behave themselves as they had the principles according to which they could or should, which is one of the reasons for the Reformation. Now the theology. At 7 minutes after 8. What we want to examine is this, what I consider the most characteristic single feature of Catholic Christianity. Not because in itself it is so distinctive, but because of its implications, theological implications. First Christian perfection itself, the word perfect in English somehow means something which is finished, which is complete, which is filled or fulfilled, which is what, say, it should be. Now, immediately, we ask ourselves, what kind of perfection, and this is where we begin, what kind of perfection is conceivable in terms of degrees? Two of the three, in terms of degrees, will not directly pertain to our examination, but they should be seen by way of contrast. If, and we're going to develop this at length, that is the love of God, whatever else perfection is, it is the love of God, and we want to say that you develop them. First we take the degrees. There is Christian perfection at its absolutely perfect or ultimate, where, if perfection means all that it is possible to do, then, when God is loved to his capacity, that is absolute perfection. And of course, who alone can love God to his capacity? Philippi, only God. So that's out of the picture as far as we're concerned. Then we can take the other correlative, because we have two termini. If Christian perfection is loving God, that can be that God is loved to our capacity. Now that is, if by definition we have a capacity for loving God, it is possible but not in this life. That then therefore is called correctly beatific Christian perfection. I should, by the way, say that the absolute Christian perfection was observed by one man, by Christ, as God loving himself. The beatific kind of perfection, which is reaching the capacity of human nature, where God is loved to our capacity, that is reserved for the beatific vision for heaven. And incidentally, we will have different capacities, so that God will be loved to our capacity, but they will in turn be different for different people. And finally, coming down to earth, there is the earthly Christian perfection. And here, we've got to begin to dig a little bit. When and in what sense is God said to be loved perfectly, and there must be degrees then, on earth? When everything that is contrary to this love is excluded. That's St. Thomas' definition. When everything which is contrary to the love of God is excluded. Now there must be therefore degrees and levels of that exclusion. By definition it means that other things can be loved not just along with God, which is life, but in place of God, instead of God, outside of God. In that sense, there is a competition. To the extent to which something less than God competes with my love of God, to that extent, on earth, my love of God is not perfect. Now, that can be looked at in two ways. And here, we use the teaching both of Aquinas and of Kellerman following Ignatius. If the earthly love of God or the earthly perfection consists in removing or in not having, excluding things which compete with my love of God, all things that would be contrary to that love, then the immediate thing is to ask myself, what are things that are contrary to the love of God? And immediately we distinguish two types of contrariness. And it is here is the essence of Christian perfection, properly so called. Here is the heart of it. There are certain things that faith tell me compete with my love for God, and which, if I don't exclude, I offend God and am liable to punishment for having chosen that or those things in place of God. Notice it's always creator and creature. This runs through all of Christian asceticism. And as the one is sacrificed, the other is more enjoyed, and conversely. Now, in Catholic terminology, and this is partly in Aquinas, partly in Bellarmine, in terms of precept, in terms, in other words, of the things that I must exclude, and if I don't love God as I should, there are those things that are binding on my conscience, as we say in Catholic terminology, under pain of grave sin, being liable to everlasting punishment. Such would be the major precepts of, say, the Decalogue. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Those grave precepts, if disobeyed, if it's, in other words, I do kill, or if I do commit adultery, what if I do? Equivalently, I choose something less than God, my own will, my desires, my passions, you name it, okay, contrary to God's will, and I am thereby not loving God, not loving Him as I should, either because of having chosen a creature that is forbidden me gravely, or having chosen something that is not forbidden me gravely, but that nevertheless, in Catholic terminology, I sin, telling a lie, stealing a quarter, being unkind to somebody that I should be kind to.
It's past ten after.
Past ten after?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. You broke at a nice point. 10 minute drop. Full nine. And that, as a precept, I fail, and therefore do not reach a certain degree, to the extent to which I choose something less than God, which is either gravely or not so gravely binding on my conscience. Then, and this is the significant point, there is also a sense in which God may be loved, where the manifestation of God's will is not in terms of a command or a precept, but rather of a counsel. If you will be perfect. Now behind that stands really a twofold principle. On the one hand, first, the admission that a human being, although fallen, has a free will sufficiently intact to make it possible for him to love God and do things beyond what he absolutely has to under pain of sin. There must be a capacity, otherwise it would be meaningless. Secondly, and more importantly, that God does so manifest his will. Namely and unexpectedly, that God gives human people options. Now, in many ways, it's not surprising, because it shows a respect for human freedom. And in human relations, we see it so frequently exercised. There are certain things that we really demand of those who say have a duty towards us. Mother towards her child, or vice versa, husband and wife, certain things which if you don't get, you are hurt, offended. In fact, you may be estranged. A wife expects and demands that her husband be faithful. If he is not, the friendship is broken. Well, it's maybe, and she's right, permitted to break it. But between that basic minimum or such like and the thousand and one amenities that she would like to have her husband show towards her stands all the difference between a strict obligation and an option. Now, in comparable language, and the scriptures are filled with such implications, God too manifests his will, as Catholic theology believes, not only in terms of commanding us to do something, but also bidding, inviting. Now, what does this have to do with the will of God? And how, especially, does it tie in with the love of God? Now, here's a subtlety. Because if the actual love of God is something that is prescribed, how can we intelligently speak of there being some sort of a counsel to it? If we're supposed to love God, and that's a duty, well, what more can I do than love him? Now, there are two ways of looking at it, and it is Aquinas who principally stresses this, as found in the passages that you may have read for class, I hope, today. Where certain obstacles are removed, and the removal of those obstacles, of course, is a very positive thing, as we'll see in a moment, are the things that our creatures, as we call them, they are not God, they are things that are part of life, and which in themselves are neither good nor bad. But which, if I, in my greater than ordinary generosity, remove from my life, sacrifice, in other words, it makes the love of God for me more expeditious. It will give me a chance to be more profoundly in love with God, to be more generous, more self-sacrificing, more self-giving. There are mainly three. There are others, of course, that have been known to Christian asceticism and are practiced, but there are mainly three when we analyze them. It is here, therefore, that the three vows, as they are called, of poverty, chastity, and obedience begin. Remember, this is centuries in development, the theology of it. Remember, to begin with, we start with the premise, this is not something which is obligatory. It is not a question of accepting or rejecting something that is binding on me under pain of sin. No. But, if I look about me, living an ordinary human life, and I ask, now let's see, what things, if I was not encumbered by, I could love God more perfectly? At least give more time to it, if nothing else. Well, there really are only three things possible. There are the things that I possess in terms of material possessions, wealth of any kind, whether monetary or real, well, you name it. There are the pleasures of body, and along with that, the psychological pleasures that are associated with family life. And there is what is, for all people, the most difficult thing, not to, you might say, do their own will. Perhaps the most difficult thing would be not to do one's own will, and one of the sweetest things, no matter how much a person may have given up of everything else, no matter what other sacrifices he makes, the last citadel of autonomy is one's own will. And consequently, over the centuries, Christian theology has bethought itself of three kinds of sacrifice, which if made, will remove what might be called obstacles, or better, what if not present, will give me a chance to grow more facilely, more deeply in that love of God. And therefore poverty corresponds to material good, which I give up, the trios. Chastity gives up the prospect of marriage and family life with all of its legitimate pleasures and satisfactions, and obedience to another human being whom I don't have to obey. That is, I don't have to undertake the length of obedience. But if I do, I thereby sacrifice that which is the hardest thing to give up for any human being. The free choice of getting up when you want to, and retiring when you want to, and doing what you please. That is the typical approach as found in the Summa, and it is classic in Catholic theology. But now there is another viewpoint given to the same concept as developed by Ignatius of Loyola and that Bellarmine developed and expatiated on. Now this doesn't go into the minutiae of say, poverty, chastity, and obedience, material goods, marriage, and self-will, although it includes these, it rather asks, what is the language of love? That's Ignatius. Now, the language of love is that I want to be like the one whom I love. Now, by this time, this is the 16th century. So that's 400 years, approximately, since Aquinas. Much had happened in the meantime. Among the astounding developments had been a Christologizing of the faith, a centering of attention on the person of Christ in a way in which we don't find even in St. Thomas. For St. Thomas, the focal point of all existence is the Trinity, part of which, of course, is the Incarnation and all that has to do with Christ. By the 16th century, and this, by the way, has a lot to do with the Reformation too, the Reformation had a lot to do with focusing the attention. Now we're dealing with, let's say, 4 centuries of development. We're dealing with that whole period of the later Middle Ages, the brethren of the common life, of Kempis, the imitation of Christ. See? Which means there is a, you don't like to call it a reorientation, but a concretization of what this thing is all about. Namely, for Ignatius and for Bellarmine, therefore, at this point, which is the heart of Christian perfection, it is the love of God indeed, but in the person of Christ, who is God. And that, ladies and gentlemen, makes a great big difference. And only a man of faith could make that elation. In other words, the development was to identify this Christian perfection, which is the love of God, with the love of God in the person of Christ, who is God. But that gives it a concrete, you might say, situation. It gives it a framework. It puts you inside the Gospels. It puts you at the disposal, if you will, of all the virtues of Christ, whom by studying, whom by imitating, you are loving God. It takes it from the realm of abstraction and brings it down to earth. It makes Christianity real with the reality of the human being called Christ. And then when Ignatius examines this business of the councils, remember what we're after. We're after the concept of perfection, of Christian perfection. which is the love of God. What is it? Aquinas would say, in good theological terms, it means the removal of those things that would stand in the way of a complete dedication to God. And he would then argue to the councils by that principle. Ignatius, more positively, although there is a positiveness about Aquinas too, but the positiveness in Ignatius, and Bellarmine, of course, is writing, Ignatius is not a theologian, Bellarmine was. And by the way, this is, it's always well to know that in the Christian religion, these things always come in duets. There is always a mystic and a theologian. If the mystic doesn't have a theologian around quick, he's going to die a boring, see? And a theologian without a mystic, he's a bad egg. Because he'll just theologize and spin all kinds of webs out of thin air, out of his own little mind. But given a great mystic with great insights, as Ignatius was. Now sometimes you find a combination, and Aquinas was that. However, in Ignatius' case, he did not theologize. Bellarmine is the great theologian of the Jesuit order. And for him then, when you come to examine what is this going beyond the call of duty? None of it is responding to doing more than you have to. Or who is the paragon? Who is the paradigm, the great model of going beyond what you have to do? That's Christ. And his whole life is a tissue of such actions. His very becoming man is supererogation, personified. He just opens the floodgates. Then you can swim, pick up anything. And this was, of course, as you may know, this was the beginning of a completely new venture in Christian asceticism. Nothing since in Catholic theology has remained untouched by that principle, nothing. Now Ignatius himself got it from his forebears. But it was Bellarmine who first theologized it, and of course since then, especially through some of the teaching of the Jesuit order for some time now, a great deal has happened. Now concretely, let's examine this just a little more before, because we've got much more to see, you know, there's one whole half more to cover. But still on the level of the councils. It would mean that in the language of love, I want to be like the one whom I love, who in this case is Christ, who is God. And then, Eli asks, what is there in the life of Christ, or can I somehow summarize it? There are a lot of individual details, the Gospels of Philemon, and many others by implication. But if I were to ask, what is it concretely or even psychologically which characterized Christ's doing what he didn't have to do? Ignatius would say it is the acceptance of the cross. Now the cross is not only in that ultimate terminal Calvary sense of crucifixion, but as is mentioned in Ignatius and repeated by Bellarmine and referred to by the apostle as referring to Christ, having joy set before him, he chose the cross. Theologically then it would be that a person goes beyond the call of duty when given an option, now watch this, given the option between two actions, both of which are good. At this stage, you see we are past the level of mere command, or whether I like it or not, whether it's pleasant or not. If I'm forbidden under pain of sin, I don't do it. Or if I'm commanded under pain of sin, I do it. We're beyond that stage. This is the language of love now, the language of the council, of perfection. Given to actions, it's hypothesizing, but the principle is clear. Both of which are good. Which will I choose? That which costs me more. And notice, not because intrinsically it is a better action, less still because, say, it's commanded, but just because it costs me more. Why choose it? Because Christ did so. Now this again, you see, opens a huge panorama, and into that you can put, among other things, okay, poverty, chastity, obedience, and you name it.
Father, this could be subjectively different for different people too. What might look us more perfect to somebody else externally could be the opposite.
Very true. Very, very true.
And it's hard to judge.
Yes. Each man stands before God. That's right. Now if we go on, this at that point is where, when I give a retreat, that's where I begin. An 8-day retreat, of course, 8 times 4 is 32 times 45 minutes, so we can talk for a long time. But now, if we take it up on the basis of obligation, this is partly a recapitulation and partly, I trust, a clarification. We're back again to the love of God. We're now asking, in terms of obligation, can we distinguish the love of God? And we are always speaking of the only kind of perfection that is accessible to human beings on earth. Namely this. It's always this. The obligation may be distinguished either as coming from God or as you might see incumbent on me, always the two correlatives. In terms of the obligation coming from God, it may be a true obligation in which a command is either forbidding or ordering positively to do something, and then we have a precept, and behind it always is something which we haven't mentioned before, is God's justice which is involved and is punishing if I disobey. Okay? That's part of the color, you might say, of a precept. So although it is loving God, nevertheless, there's a certain love of God that I owe him. Okay? It is a debt. That's what justice is. It is giving him his due. And if I don't, I suffer. And the suffering is real, it's not a metaphor. Punishment, at least due to it. But now, although placed lower here, actually on a higher level, there is where obligation as such really ceases, although we've got the word there, obligation. It is not technically obligation anymore, but rather recommendation. God, in other words, offers me, after all his attributes are infinite. He is not only a just God. There is more to God than just that. Yet he wants to, as he has in the person of Christ, reveal to me facets of his infinity which go beyond the strict justice that I owe him. And he tells me now, you are not obliged under pain of sin or correlative punishment, but as an opportunity. And in fact, the better word would be opportunity as contrasted with obligation. And that would correspond to what is technically called counsel, which by definition, to contrast it with precept, is not binding under sin. In other words, should I not undertake to go beyond the call of duty, to make sacrifices, to do things that are not binding under sin, well, I don't commit a sin, and I'm not liable to punishment. Now, on man's part, on man's side, the two are not perfectly superimposable, as it were, this upon that. Nevertheless, there is a correlation. On our part, there is such a thing as my loving God in terms of just the love itself, the actual loving. Well, there can be, you might say, no more or less, as though I've got some kind of an option, as though God says, now I want you to love me, under pain of sin to 60 degrees.
Sure.
Like a man says, with your whole heart, as far as the act goes, the actual love is measureless, because God is measureless. But wherein then is there a measure? Is there a degree? Where can I go beyond the call of duty? It is in the means that I use, which implements, facilitates, make possible, amplify, deepen my love of God. So what I do, for example, I may give up certain things which will expedite my love of God, and therein lies the measure and the degree. Now it is possible, as you might expect, a person who has never, say, been called upon, never had to exercise, say, that kind of sacrifice of creatures, and yet in himself, a man of the world, a millionaire, may love God more than an ostensibly poor religious. Only God measures that. But in terms of human language, it's the only language we've got, where there's a more or less, where we distinguish between precept and degree, what I am commanded is to love God and love Him as much as I can, in terms of my actual loving, my sentiment, my affection. What I can do something about, and where I am given the option of degree, is the means that I use. But in other words, I can, if I want to, remove certain things that, humanly speaking, will expedite. And of course, God will consider that as a sacrifice to Himself. And in that sense, there is a greater love of God. So we don't want to mistake means for ends, as though people who take the vow, say, necessarily love God more. Maybe they don't. But those who make the sacrifices use means at their disposal, and in that sense, there are degrees of self-sacrifice and of giving up for the love of God. Yeah. Now we go up to the essence itself. And as much time as we have, how much do we have? 20 minutes? Now this, the essence itself. On this, the great theologian is Augustine. And I would say, and by the way, I would like to have you read the Confessions of St. Augustine. If you cannot, during the summer at least, remember that I asked you to read the Confessions of St. Augustine in the near future if you have not read them. They are, in many ways, both a confession of one's, well, Augustine's sinfulness and a profession of the love of God, I think the greatest autobiography ever written. It is, in many ways, as you've read it, know, a monologue, a dialogue, if you will, with God, but he touches all the bases, you might say. Pulls out all the stoppers on this business of the love of God. All the theology that we will see here is in Augustine. It was developed by Aquinas, and Bellarmine particularly, in certain facets, added some clarification. But by and large, the principles were already there in Augustine. The love of God, and we are here, of course, speaking not of God's love for us, but of ours for Him. The English love of God is ambiguous. It means our love for Him. We can, first of all, what are we after? We're trying to explore and understand this whole business here. And remember, Christian perfection covers everything, but also in particular to know what this is about. Now in terms of the metaphysics of divine love, what we have seen before was more of the psychology, if you will. Now we are taking up the philosophy of the metaphysics. By definition, love always implies two or more persons. At least even when one loves oneself, you take it in terms of reflecting on oneself. And consequently, in terms of my love for God, I can distinguish between a self-interested love of Him and one which is not so self-interested. A technical name for that first kind of love which is said to be self-interested is called the love of concupiscence. It is not concupiscence. It is good. In fact, it is a virtue. In fact, it may be called the virtue of hope. Meaning what? When I love anyone, self-interestedly, I have an eye to getting something in return. In general, I suppose most Christmas cards are sent